Hello and welcome to this week's edition of A Hard Place with me, Dominic Searle. A Hard Place is a space to talk about the issues that directly or indirectly affect your everyday lives, as seen from a Gibraltar perspective. Well, 50 years ago, November the 20th, 1975, after a very long night, a Europa Press journalist sends a telegram with three repeated phrases: Franco ha muerto, Franco ha muerto, Franco ha muerto, Franco is dead. For weeks, people in Gibraltar, aware of his hospitalization, were keeping at least metaphorical champagne in the fridge. And I recall as a teenager that that weekend when the news broke, it was endless solemn music and requiems playing on Televisión Española, I assume, while sort of people were trying to work out what was going to happen politically in Spain. I'm joined today in the Washroom Studios by Giles Tremlett, who's an historian, a writer, and for many years Guardian correspondent based in Madrid. I don't think you're doing the Guardian anymore, but he has several books mainly on Spain. Following his recent history of the international brigades, he's come out with a timely edition on El Caudillo, General Franco, whose death 50 years ago opened the journey for Spaniards to democracy. Giles, welcome to A Hard Place. The timing of the book, El Generalísimo Franco, Power, Violence, and the Quest for Greatness, doesn't just mark some sort of distant episode. Franco remains sort of hauntingly present for all of us in the Iberian Peninsula. What was your aim of writing the book now?
Well, there's an obvious reason for publishing something now. The English edition of this book has come out in November 2025, which is exactly 50 years after his death. The Spanish edition in this case actually came out 6 months earlier. So I've been having the very interesting experience of going around Spain, talking to and with people about Franco. But no, the first thing, the priority here is 50 years have gone by. Franco is history, or should be history. So let's take another look at it.
There's a tradition, because Brennan, Preston, books about Franco, there's a tradition almost of British, I know you've been in Spain a long time, but of British writers writing about Spain. I think in the recent years, there's a little bit more discussion about what's going on there. But, you know, what do you make of the Spanish sort of marking of this of event?
Well, I think it's very interesting. Almost on the date, and the day we broadcast this, we will be absolutely on the date. It's not as loud as I would have liked. I think there is a lot for Spaniards to say and to think about as regards Franco. But it's louder than it was 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And so some of the taboos around discussing Franco, around discussing the Civil War, are going away. That process has been quite gradual, but it's still, you know, fascinating to be speaking to Spaniards about Franco.
I remember as a child in the 70s, early 70s, a few years before he must have died, an entourage passing. I was in Marbella when it was a fishing village, and yet it took quite a few years for the bust of Franco to be removed from the central square. And my grandfather used to tell me about in the Civil War days, he lost a brother fighting against Franco, how you'd go to a barber's and you know, you'd have one of the sort of soldiers or fascists having a shave, and there'd be a gun behind the barber. And equally, my grandmother tells stories about going to the market. The fashion in those days, surprisingly, women would wear their watches on their ankles and lift their skirts to see the time, and that they were being arrested by the Guardia Civil for this sort of immoderate behavior. And I just wondered, in the course of your book, what's the cultural impact of Franco? What did he actually do to Spain over those, you know, three or four decades?
Well, it's interesting that you should tell an anecdote about women and their public behavior, because I think one of my sort of ideas about Franco is that Francoism isn't really an ideology in the left-right sense as we think about it. It's very difficult to pin, you know, fascism on it, even though there were moments of totalitarian temptation, shall we say. But what there was a very strict control of society, a very strict control of what could be said in public, and in some cases, a very strict control of what could be done in public and even what could be done in private. And women, especially, were the people who knew this because they had a lot of their rights taken away immediately, all the extra rights that the Republic had given them in terms of divorce, civil marriage, and even rights over their own property. Suddenly, we went back in time. Franco was a reactionary. Franco hated the 19th century of Spain. He thought it should be wiped out. So in many ways, he wanted to take people back to the 18th century. And in terms of, of behavior, the way that women were treated and the relationships between men and women were actually a key part of this kind of the Francoist project. There was actually an obsession with the concept of sort of Iberian virility, which even underpins Francoism.
The sense I get from what I've read of from the book is you recognise in Franco actually a very sort of he's a strategist really. No, he's I mean it's an odd strategy, but it's he things don't just happen out by chance. He's a very controlling figure, who in a sense is people seem to almost forget or want to forget the violence that he created. It's only now that people are sort of looking back at that again. I mean, what is the personality that you found there?
Okay, so there's this, massive error, which is people thinking that Franco was a mediocre character. He wasn't charismatic in any way, and that's absolutely true, but he wasn't mediocre, nor was his family mediocre. You go back to his childhood and he's sharing a bedroom with, Ramon Franco, who's his brother, who's, the first pilot to fly, across the Atlantic from Spain to Argentina, something that was, you can follow that flight daily in the pages of the New York Times. And there's even a moment where when the Alzamiento happens, where the foreign press is talking about, there's this guy called General Franco who's in charge. He's the brother of the famous aviator. So Franco himself comes from actually quite an extraordinary family, and he's exceedingly ambitious from very young. And this ambition is what, carries him through all the way. But also, he's an extremely cold person and very indifferent to violence and the product of violence. And in that sense, he's sort of trained in the war in Morocco when he's, a young officer, and takes charge of the Spanish Legion. Helps to create the Spanish Legion, which is a notoriously, violent group of men. And he's remarkably indifferent to the use of violence. There's something in this group of Africanista officers that he is the representative of, which is almost sect-like in its sort of belief that they are the kind of chosen ones because they are prepared to give up their lives in battle for Spain, not for Spain, for the honor of Spain, not to defend Spain, but just for its to defend its honor and its reputation. And that's the spirit that he then takes into his 40 years of dictatorship, which is all about, if you want to use a, a contemporary expression, making Spain great again.
I mean, he used his sort of personality to frustrate people, didn't he? I mean, sort of the famous Hitler episode, his relationships with different people. He was always sort of playing Churchill and different characters. Was that part of it?
Yes, no, he's an extremely slippery customer. In Galicia they call it retranca. This idea that, you can't quite trust, a Galician when you meet them on the staircase. You don't know whether they're going up or down, because they'll always give you an answer that allows you to think that, both options are open. And he was very slippery in that sense. And that was part of his, part of his success, was based on that. People didn't really know who Franco was until suddenly he was in charge.
You mentioned Gibraltar a number of times in the book, and obviously people in Gibraltar will be very interested to hear. I mean, we know that Gibraltar was sort of divided. The establishment, which was the UK and quite a lot of the sort of very wealthy Gibraltarians, were sort of generally tending towards supporting Franco, whereas the trade unions and the working class people and obviously work people of similar communists and others in Spain were clearly trying to stop the Franco move. How does Gibraltar figure in your story overall? I mean, where do you think it plays in Franco's whole sort of psyche, or was it just another, piece of a political?
It's very important to him. I mean, it has an actual role in a couple of moments. You know, during the Civil War, when there are arguments about whether the Republican fleet can refuel in Gibraltar. Eventually it can't, and that's actually quite an important moment. There's also during the Second World War, Operation Torch in the north of Africa, which is really where the course of the Second World War changes, when the Allies invade Morocco and Algeria, and that is actually run from Gibraltar. And it's a very important moment in the war, and it's very important for Franco, because it's when he realizes that he's been backing a loser. He's been backing Hitler up until then. And of course, part of backing Hitler was having a plan to take Gibraltar. And that plan was made, and it was, it was on the table. And if Spain ever had joined the war, that would have been one of the first things to happen. So in that sense, Gibraltar is very important. It's one of the things he wanted when he was doing a deal with Hitler. After that, it sort of becomes, that useful object, which sometimes it continues to be, which is, a beast to be beaten and held up as an example of how the world mistreats Spain because it's stolen its territory and won't give it back.
In the last years, when the Queen comes over, that really seems to push it for him. He seems to, the border was actually closed longer after his death than before his death. It's nonetheless really very much part of what he wanted to leave behind, isn't it? The legacy would have been to have Gibraltar before he died, do you think?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, what he wanted to begin with was a new empire. So, I mean, he was far more ambitious than just Gibraltar to begin with. He wanted a new empire, and obviously as the dictator, he would have been the emperor. He couldn't do that because Spain didn't have the power. But as his great obsession is Spain's, position, whether Spain is being respected or looked down on. And so it's all about pride and national pride. And that is why he is so thoroughly obsessed by Gibraltar. And in that sense, Gibraltar is, another fail on the list of Franco fails, because it's something he wanted and it's something he did not get.
Well, on that note, we'll take a short break. You're listening to the podcast A Hard Place, and I'm Dominic Searle. If you have any questions or short comments, please send them to listengibraltar@outlook.com. That's one word, all lowercase, listengibraltar@outlook.com. Or just search out my name on Substack and message me. One of the interesting interviews that I've been reading, because I've had quite a lot of material in the El País in particular, and Nicolás Sartorius, who was the co-founder of Comisión Obrera, the trade union back in the time, he talks about, one, the fact that Franco started violent and finished violent, that was part of his oppressive nature, and he was much more, a bit romanticized sometimes outside of Spain. And the other thing is, I think, which is really, I find very interesting, the timing, like your book, of the King's book, i.e. the King Emeritus, Juan Carlos, where you've got this. I don't know whether you think he's. Do you think he's opening up? He thinks that populism around the world gives him the opportunity to say that he was fairly sympathetic. I would have thought it was a mistake to say that for him anyway. But he seems to have said it. But Sartorius is very clear that when Franco died, that the king was fairly ambivalent. It was only his father, basically, who said, "You know, we've lost the monarchy. If you don't." Go ahead with democracy. And I remember equally there was a German at the time of the 23 F in 1981, when Tejero tried sort of to take over the parliament and there was a sort of attempted coup. German journalists sort of saying, well, actually, that the ambassador had sent a report, the German ambassador sent a report reflecting an ambiguity in King Juan Carlos. Where does King Juan Carlos fit into all this, do you think?
Well, Juan Carlos is immensely ambiguous at the moment of Franco's death. I mean, in fairness, he has always been honest. I mean, not very vocal, but when asked, honest about the fact that, you know, he actually quite liked Franco and he's not going to criticize him. Franco is the man who handpicked him for the job. So in that sense, at least he's being honest about it. But certainly, you know, as soon as Franco dies, you know, his first speeches are thanking Franco and recognizing the legitimacy of the regime that was founded on the legitimate war in the Civil War of 1936 to 1939, and he's constantly going on about how the Francoist period is legitimate. The Francoist regime is legitimate. And in a way, he has to, because he is, you know, the heir to all of that. In many ways, you know, Juan Carlos receives a dictator's power and then gives it up. The question is then, how do you look at it? Is he a sort of like a glasnost figure from Russia who we thank for, you know, for giving all that up? Or is he, a devious player who made the most out of the situation to keep as much power for himself?
And from the messages or the telegrams that Kissinger sent in, from what I was reading again in El País, clearly America and others were not sort of in a rush for Spain to become communist. So there was an eagerness to keep it somewhere in the sort of right, as it were, rather than the left. In the interview with Sartorius in El País, one of the interesting things I found was that they mentioned that they've done a survey recently, finding that 21%. Of Spaniards think that Franco was either good or very good. And also, there's a huge concern, which the Sartorius himself expresses, about the sort of level of amnesia or people are not really understanding what that period was like, what dictatorship was like to live in. And curiously enough, we've just had our literary festival in Gibraltar, and João de Almeida, the former EU ambassador to UK, was talking about his memory of Portugal and how people have forgotten what Portuguese dictatorship was like. Is this a serious problem with Spain? Is Vox going to be a big problem for all of us, do you think?
Well, I think it's a serious problem for Spain, but I think it's been a serious problem from Franco's times. I mean, Franco himself deliberately sought the ignorance and the apathy of the Spanish people. So he controlled the press. You know, from 1938 to 1966, there was a press law inspired by Goebbels, according to Franco's own brother-in-law, Serrano Suñer, where the control of the press was absolute. And so Spaniards received in their newspapers this message of a sort of a country where nothing bad ever happens, and there is this glorious and wise and paternalistic leader. And at the same time, they're receiving this message that they have no reason to get involved in politics. That's all been settled. They shouldn't be thinking about it. And so, you know, even as we leave Francoism, forms part of what Spain is in the 1970s, and you can't just change that overnight. So then what happens? Then you have the transition, and the transition is based partly on the idea that we have to remain silent about it. Not only that, but there's actually an amnesty for the old Francoist henchmen, if you want. It's in, you know, it's passed through Parliament, and then it's considered to be in bad taste to talk about the Civil War or to talk about Franco, and then it's not taught at schools. And in fact, when I've been promoting this book and I've been talking to university students, they're telling me that still, when they were doing the bachillerato a couple of years ago, their teachers still weren't going there. Somehow that bit of history sort of fell off the end of the course. And so we have a genuine problem in that Spaniards don't know about one of the most important parts of their most recent history. And they don't know about Franco, you know, the most important figure in two centuries of Spanish history. And they don't know about everything that happened before the transition, which entirely conditioned the transition itself. And that's the problem, more than whether this means, you know, the far right will be more powerful or the young are kind of tending towards the far right, which is happening everywhere. It's more the sort of the overall ignorance about what it was like, what happened, what it meant. And, you know, some young people on the far right, you know, have the word freedom written on their T-shirt. And then they're talking about how great it was to live under a dictatorship, which is the opposite of freedom.
So I know you're really busy, so I'm just going to one more question for you.
Go ahead.
Looking ahead, you may be aware that there's a treaty coming up, which is the UK-EU Treaty on Gibraltar, but essentially has involved Gibraltar and Spain talking a lot to each other, apart from the UK and the EU.
Finally,
and that's going to bring down the fence, or a lot of it anyway, which you may recall Felipe González called the Garlic Wall, that he wanted to put daisies across there. But, you know, there is the risk, obviously, that even when we get this treaty through and there's that kind of normality, fluidity and closer ability to cooperate and so forth, of alternate governments coming in and turning the screws again. I mean, we were members of the European Union, and occasionally governments in Spain would still turn the screws on the border. How do you see politics evolving in Spain in a way that it might accept this agreement? Do you think that we've moved on enough that despite all the sort of, you know, issues about Franco and all the rest of it, Spain is another place now?
I like to think that we've moved on enough. I like to think that, you know, the tighter the sort of, the more tightly entwined the economies of Gibraltar and the Campo de Gibraltar are, the more, the stronger, you know, the recent agreements will be. And I hope that that's a kind of virtuous cycle that we're going into, that the agreement itself will produce greater integration, and greater integration itself will make it harder to break the agreements. Historically, of course, we've seen, you know, when the right or the far right is around, you know, Gibraltar is something they want to turn against. And so, you know, it's still possibly there. And of course, you know, now that Gibraltar is out of the EU and Britain is out of the EU, that itself is a problem. But maybe in this case, the fact that it's actually an EU agreement or an EU overseen agreement helps to, you know, helps to give it, you know, a greater degree of permanence. But if I was Gibraltarian, I don't think I would be entirely relaxed about the future.
Well, Giles, thanks very much for being with us. Your book is available in all the usual places, and Kindle for sure as well, because I've got it now. Well, that was Giles Tremnett, historian, writer, and journalist, whose book, El Generalísimo, Franco, Power, Violence, and the Quest for Greatness, is just out in English. Join me in a few days' time with Andrew McKinley for another episode of A Hard Place. It's the James Wood Trio.